Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight because I'm in University of California, Irvine. I'm Samuel Mann. I'm supported tonight by the Newkirk Centre for Science and Society. I'm in the office of Dr. Deli Ugucheta, who is the Professor and Chair of the Department of Population Health and Disease Prevention at the Program in Public Health at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Welcome to Irvine.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nigeria. I spent my first 22 years or so in Nigeria, most of it in boarding school and college. And
what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was very good at drawing, and so I was a bit torn between fine arts and biology, where I also thought you could use drawing. In those days, we didn't have the automatic download the pictures and the drawings and the diagrams. But I went to a boarding high school where you couldn't really do both. And so I had to choose, and I chose biology in part because I believed it would be a guarantee for employment. So I went and studied microbiology as an undergraduate and decided to do my PhD at the University of Tennessee, where I began to focus on how to use bacteria to detoxify pollutants that are toxic and contaminants in the environment. The lab that I worked with specialized on polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, which were at the time amongst the most recalcitrant and dangerous chemicals we had.
Beyond thinking that if you went into biology, you'd get to draw things, mm-hmm. Did you have a mission? Did you want to save the world, or?
Yeah, if you ask my parents, they would, I think, say that it was personal. I remember my mom telling stories to her friends how I kept my toothbrush in the fridge all the time to avoid germs. So I was always a little bit self-protective in that sense. When I started my undergraduate program in microbiology, I was lucky enough to find a professor who showed me how some fishermen were using pesticides to weaken fish so that they could catch many more. And the connection between the use of pesticides to make labor easier, but potentially poisoning the same community where these fishermen came from, really got me thinking about a broader application of my interest and self-preservation and trying to figure out not only educating people about the risks, but understanding those risks even better.
It's interesting to me that those fishermen didn't think that through.
Well, if we thought a lot of things through, we wouldn't do them. I know. I think part of it is not quite understanding the, of course, the biochemistry of pesticide residues in different fish tissue, for one, but also how long those things last in the environment, how difficult it is to reverse what they had done. Shortcuts are not uncommon in business, and you know, most people who take those shortcuts want the immediate gain, sometimes understanding the long-term damage, but not weighting it appropriately. Incidentally, that's the core of materials life cycle assessment. We put weights on things we value and different weights. And depending on what economists call discount rates, we want, you know, our money now as opposed to paying it back in the future. But yeah, it was shocking to me. It had a big impact on me that such practices happened.
Have they stopped doing it?
I have since learned that it's not restricted to that part of the world. So I don't know to what extent such practices occur. But education about pesticides I know has become something of a national challenge. The World Health Organization has campaign programs here in California. Immigrant workers and, you know, the labels on pesticide cans have become an issue, because if you say it's in English and most of the immigrants speak Spanish, you want to make sure. But the deliberate act of using pesticides indiscriminately to gain some economic benefit, I think, has dwindled. This summer here on our campus in Irvine, California, we have a beetles, an infestation of some of the magnificent trees around here, of beetles. I think they're eucalyptus trees. And I was delighted that the director of the Environmental Health Agency on campus sent me an email saying, we would like to use some pesticides, but we want some guidance on which ones to use. So that kind of consultation, awareness of risks, I think has grown. But I can't say that the practice has stopped completely.
After your PhD, what did you do next?
I had a postdoctoral fellowship to understand mercury pollution. It was funded by the Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto, California. And at the time, there was a lot of interest in removing coal from energy resources. But the private interests, you know, energy corporations, were reluctant to do so. I mean, this is still a battle in the U.S. And so coal fire plants, coal burning plants, are factories, I think is the way to say it, are one of the biggest sources of mercury in the environment. And when mercury gets into the atmosphere, precipitation moves it into water and sediments. And in sediment are bacteria that are able to transform the mercury to more potent forms, methyl mercury, that can then partition into fish. So we were trying to understand mercury detoxification by bacteria and demethylation. The disease associated with that is called Minamata disease, named after this bay in Japan, where over several decades, women were poisoned by eating fish that contained methyl mercury because of the power of a factory that dumped mercury into the bay. And the children born to those women were deformed. That's the Minamata disease. And when people saw the pictures in Life magazine, there was a big concern. And you would think we would have learned our lessons, but there are still a lot of sources of mercury into the environment that are uncontrolled. And we have advisories for pregnant women not eating certain kinds of fish, swordfish, for example, more than once a month to reduce the risk to the fetus.
Is that a common feeling? You think you would have thought we would have learned our lessons? Are you able to say whether or not we end up saying that more often than not?
Yes. Regrettable solutions to long-term problems have become another sustainability term that in our quest to solve a problem that took many decades to understand and to find alternatives, we often don't learn the lessons of doing the work ahead of adopting the alternatives. So despite all of the research about mercury, about lead, these chemicals still show up in some new ways. My work in the last decade or so with colleagues in engineering and material science has focused on lead use in electronics. We like our electronic products so much, the cell phone, the computer, laptops, and that to make them cheaply and affordable, I think at the beginning we used the cheapest materials, and there were also some of the most toxic, for example, tin lead solder. The screen of my flat screen computer probably still made with fluorescent light with mercury. All of these fluorescent lights up there have mercury in them. And so if one of these breaks, we're supposed to evacuate. So it's still here. I mean, we've learned to control it to some extent, and we can't possibly get rid of all toxic substances, but we need to try harder.
So how do we get from a postdoc on mercury to chair of public health?
Well, So I published some of the work with colleagues and mentors on mercury detoxification in sediment. I then started working on not just getting rid of the mercury, but understanding the responses that are conserved across the phylogenetic boundary. So I started working on protein molecules and enzymes that are present in bacteria, in humans, in other organisms that will indicate more systemic impact. Then I became more interested in characterizing those impacts even on people. So after a few years here at Irvine, I started commuting to UC Berkeley to learn more about the human aspect of my work in environmental health. And I earned a master's in public health at Berkeley. And at that time, our campus at UC Irvine was beginning to think about broadening the health sciences. So it was by then almost the year 2000, we had a town hall meeting, should we do public health here or not? We're a bold campus, so we embraced that vision. And I was lucky enough to have now shifted my work more in line with human health, but it's not really divorced from, you know, microbial toxicology and ecosystem health. So it added to my portfolio, so to speak. And the opportunity to help develop the undergraduate programs in public health came along. I embraced it and cherished it, and now we have 500 students in public health. 600 of them graduated this last Saturday. We did the master's in public health here. We have a PhD in public health with tracks in global health and disease prevention, and established the Department of Population Health and Disease Prevention. I think my role in those developments, why they requested that I chair the department, I'm sure there are other people who could do it better, but sometimes you stick your neck out too far. And then,
so when the recruiters are doing the road shows around the high schools,
yeah,
what do they say about public health? Why should people study it?
Yeah, it was a big surprise to me that we started with 16 students in 2006 and we have 1,000. Mm. It was a surprise to a lot of people. But this is a trend that's national. I think public health is a career path that appeals to high school students, particularly after we suffer some outbreak of, you know, you get Ebola, you get an earthquake and cholera in Haiti. So I think there are many stories in public health that high school students, actually grade school students, feel attracted to. I do go to elementary schools and I bring Petri dishes, you know, they stick their palm on it and then they go wash their hand and have a control and see the effect of soap to help them understand that these things we don't see, you know, not only are they there, but potentially that they're responsible for the infections, the colds, sometimes the sore throat, pimples, I mean, things that they can relate to. High school students are beginning to understand the basics of epidemiology, why certain diseases are present in certain communities and not others, certain countries and not others, and the idea that we can prevent many of these diseases appeals to people. So that's the message that the counselors give to recruit students at the high school level. And we do, you know, something similar here on our campus. We open up our seminar series to everybody every other week. We invite a public health luminary to come to campus or speak to us. And we videotape these seminars and put them on our open courseware. And so anybody anywhere in the world can view this, and I think that's helped tremendously.
So what does the first line of the textbook say? Public Health 101. The role of the public health professional is to
prevent disease in populations and promote health. So even if you're healthy now, there's still work to be done to make sure you understand the things you're doing that are keeping you healthy and to understand the things that are risk factors. And public health is somewhat different from medicine in the scope of work that we do. So a physician may see their responsibility as the patient in front of them. A public health professional is to understand that interaction between the physician and the patient, but also to identify what we can do for people who are not in the clinic so that we keep them away from the clinic at the large population level. Vaccination is often one of the biggest successes in public health.
If I characterize the discipline as being falling somewhere on the triangle of science, sociology, and art,
mm-hmm.
can you put percentages on those? I know that they overlap and they're the same things, but
yeah,
where would you position it?
Yeah, That's a very apt way to put it, because the first definition of public health published by Winslow in the 1920s did say public health is the science and art of keeping people healthy within. And the foundation is the science. We have to focus on evidence. You know, what is the evidence that this risk factor causes that disease? So causality is a core mission of the science of public health. Once we identify the connection between a risk factor and disease, then we can begin to prevent it. And that prevention is where the art comes in, because it needs to include not just the understanding of human behavior, policy, politics, economics, and how to appeal to the power brokers in all of those disciplines is to some extent an art. And there's ethics, of course, involved in it. There is cultural sensitivity. And to master all of those resources requires interdisciplinary collaboration, and putting together a team and leading such a team to accomplish something like eradicating a disease is an art. And it's not easy to reproduce, and I can't understate how important it is, because if we know how to reproduce that, we would have eradicated more than just smallpox, which was now, 30, 40 years ago. It's hard to reproduce the combination of factors that lead to disease eradication. But the science part, we've made tremendous progress. That coordination, leadership, mapping, prioritization, very important.
One of the tenets of sustainability is that human health, human well-being, and environmental well-being are essentially the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we say that kind of with a belief that they're connected. But it's actually the public health that's kind of central to your field, is those exploring those connections.
Yeah, so for my particular area of environmental toxicology, ecosystem health, human health, there is a balance of interest that's shifted toward worrying more about human health impacts than, the impacts on the whale or the trees. And that's because the effect is immediate and emotionally immediate. That is to say, if a family member gets cancer and we believe it's something in the water, we want action now. It often takes a little bit longer to recognize this impact on ecosystems and wildlife. That's why it's a very rich area of research. However, I think that in any case, it's a mistake to take humans out of the context of nature. I mean, we're part of it. All of our activities, our behavior, our inventions, we didn't really bring anything extra to the planet. And so having a planetary view requires that we include everything else into the sustainability equation. In public health, we tend to divide the field into skin in and skin out. So, yes, there are certain diseases that are associated with genetics. So people are presumably born with certain predispositions. But increasingly, we're understanding that some of those predispositions may not lead to the disease outcome if they aren't acted upon by additional environmental risk factors. especially in the areas of, you know, exposures to toxic chemicals. And that's because, yeah, we're exposed to many things all the time. Some of us have certain enzymes that can either make us more vulnerable or less vulnerable. And this gene-environment interaction is an important area of research. And I think we'll find that to be true for most other human diseases, not just in toxic exposures. So we can't... The line that used to be there is fading rapidly.
Probably the biggest threat we're facing, of course, is climate change.
Mm-hmm.
You draw the link there as well?
Oh, yeah. As you may be aware, one of the contentious bills in the U.S. Congress was the regulation of carbon dioxide as a, you know, hazardous pollutant. And that is a fine example of how it's difficult to separate, you know, human health from environmental health. Of course, some members of Congress think, well, we all breathe out carbon dioxide. It can't possibly be regulated as a pollutant. Yeah, but it is a pollutant. That's why we get rid of it from the human body. But we're speaking of it in the context of being hazardous to the global ecosystem. And the choice of carbon dioxide as an example is important because most of the risks to the climate are associated with our choice of energy materials, right? We could potentially move more closely to the alternatives that do not produce as much CO2. That's been the fundamental policy angle for mitigating climate change. Let's produce less CO2 because, yeah, plants need it, but there's only so much of it that plants can absorb. The oceans absorb quite a bit, but we're shifting the balance. And for public health, the impacts of climate on health are beginning to sink in for many regulatory agencies and many public health agencies. It's not just the range, the geographical range of infectious diseases such as the vector-borne, you know, malaria and it's water quality and access to water, mental health, and I've published some things on this.
Have people actually drawn a link between climate change and any evidence of direct impacts on population level health?
It's very difficult to draw that, and it goes back to my comment on causality being the core of public health science. It often takes a long time, a lot of evidence collection and analysis. The initial attempts to draw a direct link between, let's say, malaria and climate change were very controversial because, in fact, malaria used to be endemic in the United States, the southern part, and it was a campaign of pumping DDT into every pond that did it, not because the climate changed. And so temperature rise is not the only factor involved in malaria. There are other maybe stronger pieces of research coming out with respect to, you know, the heat wave is very clear that because we have examples of what has happened in the past. When we have heat waves, mortality goes up, especially with the elderly. To the extent that high temperatures and air quality, that's important, and we have very strong evidence there about the causality. We did some work on mental health and psychological restorativeness, access to the ocean. It's still a little weak, the evidence. I can't say that based on all of the collective evidence that we can say that's a reason to worry about climate change.
Is it strong enough that I'm going to assume that there is a professional body of public health people. Has that body come out and said there is a link?
Yes. In fact, in the next week or so, there is a summit in the White House. The U.S. president is calling a summit of climate and health.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an article in 2003, I believe, that talked about framing the issues. Health impacts are often a way to increase the salience of any topic. And using it in the climate change discussion always heightens attention. And I think it's not deceptive. So the evidence is strong enough to call a summit to let's look at this closer. Where would the impacts be? If, for example, those who are claiming that the increasing numbers of tornadoes, natural disasters, drought in California associated with climate change, we can estimate how many people will die or get sick as a result of these kinds of events. But the problem, of course, is we've always had these events before we understood climate change, and separating what will be normal cycling of events versus a heightened response to climate is where we're now needing to do more work.
Given that the causality is the core of is at the core of public health science, and the scientific uncertainty around whether or not people are going to call, no one's prepared to call this particular hurricane as a result of climate change. Mm-hmm. And given that most sustainability problems are wicked problems, mm-hmm. which aren't conducive to being able to be described as causality, how does public health education deal with the messiness of all that?
Yes, this is an important point. I wrote an article in The Lancet 2013 about how to deal with uncertainty when we're trying to protect the most vulnerable people. Okay. It's a responsibility of all sustainability scientists to communicate uncertainty. But that's not a license to not act. The article I wrote was about whether or not exposure to electronic waste, e-waste, is causing disease. This has become one of the fastest growing problems in environmental health. We're generating e-waste, we're distributing them all over the world. Children sometimes walk in these places, and there's a lot of evidence that they're exposed. Blood lead levels are high, flame retardant levels are high, but are these actually causing disease enough to take the jobs away? Tough question. People need jobs, but they should do it safely. So I said, yes, there's uncertainty in the epidemiology. We never have 100% correspondence between exposure and disease, even for tobacco smoking, where we have a lot of evidence. And still yet, there are some people who smoke and don't get lung cancer. So we cannot afford to wait to get rid of all uncertainty before we formulate policy. And we've done that over and over. When the weight of evidence is strong, and we use statistics to kind of identify that strength, then we say, let's protect people. even if not everybody would succumb to disease.
I'm thinking of the of the relationship that's in sustainability. So there is the rockstrom, the limits, that were beyond the limits approach, those absolute limits. We're going to run out of this at this
yeah.
time here.
Yeah.
And that almost contrasts, although they do work together, with the approach coming out of, and that's coming out of Stockholm, coming out of Karlskrona, is the strategic sustainability approach, which focuses more on the identification of processes as limits
mm-hmm.
and having the principles. And they relate that to, rather than saying, here is, they relate it to chess. Here is the you know, if the king is here and the queen is here and the this is here, then that's checkmate. And there's however many yeah. million combinations. Instead of doing that, they say, these are the conditions under which the king cannot move, the king can't do this. So they identify those principles. So the accumulation of substances out of the Earth's crust is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter that we don't know the limit at which that's unsustainable, just the fact that we're doing it
it's
is unsustainable.
Changed, yeah. Yeah.
So is that the direction that public health could perhaps take? That it's a... we don't have to prove this particular thing is killing people at this rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because and what I'm thinking of is smoking. How,
yeah.
how many years did it take following that approach to get rid of smoking?
Yeah. Yeah, in retrospect, I think most public health researchers, professionals would wish we had implemented the anti-smoking campaign a lot sooner. I mean, all public health students learn about Sir Hill, who gave us the some conditions by which you would be able to examine the weight of evidence. And I believe at least since the 1950s we've had sufficient evidence to regulate smoking massively, but public health is always pitched against some economic interests. People want to sell products and make money doing so, and always underestimating the risk is the approach that group has taken, and the same is happening with climate change now. If you want to sell more petroleum, you underestimate the risks. yes, we would have perhaps reduced the number of lung cancer cases and emphysema cases if we had done things sooner. I think that we're also in public health grappling with this idea about population growth and, you know, just how many people can the Earth sustain. I challenge my students in public health because we are never satisfied. You know, I tell them, look at the population growth of the planet. If an alien were to come and look at how fast we've grown, how many diseases we have limited their impacts in all parts of the world. Life expectancy, as we've only known it to be going one direction, that's up. How can you say there are problems? You know.
Are we back to your petri dish?
Except if you think, like in my bacterial cultures, that there is a plateau coming followed by a crash. That's the normal cycle of things, and we may not be exempt from that.
We're pretty clever, though.
We're very clever, and so we can keep the lag phase or the logarithmic growth phase on and on and on indefinitely. But we know that's not the nature of things. One of the reasons there's a crash, disease, farming, and natural disasters and events, and that's it. That's what we understand by studying other organisms.
Do those simple organisms, Is there a model in there for self-regulation?
There's a model for resistance to disease. There's a model for, we will have quorum sensing now understood in microbiology, where organisms can limit their reproductive rates in response to sensing how much nutrients are available. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, we do it here. I mean, but these are political decisions sometimes, as China tried to, for example, say one child, one family policy. And they are very difficult. So understanding the limits, which is difficult, does not give us the instruments we need to kind of regulate ourselves below those limits. That's where we are now. I don't believe we're yet at the limit. Yes, you know, how many people can the Earth sustain? How many people can we have without some epidemic wiping out a big portion? We don't know that. But even if we did, okay, we have no way of knowing where is the stable region. And I maybe I misunderstood, but I think I get this idea that we need not that limit, but the processes before the limit that we can regulate and not necessarily impose, but that with understanding, people will buy into the idea that, no, you don't need to use up all of the petroleum. You know, right now, we have the ability to find alternatives. We don't need to continue to smoke until every last person is dead. We don't need to continue to use lead until, you know, we have the understanding now to kind of know before we reach the limit, what are the conditions that make us healthy and well.
You talked before about framing change in Africa, and one of the things that's always had a big impact on me was I was at a UN Education for Sustainability conference, and we'd been talking for, you know, 3 days about education for sustainability, and somebody from Mozambique, I think, stood up and said, this is a luxury. Yeah. We're so far away from this light and happiness thing that you're talking about. We've missed the point entirely.
Well, I disagree with the fellow African who said that. I think this was not uncommon earlier in the discussion about climate change, and not in the West as well. And I think it was in part the way the United Nations Framework Convention framed the issue at the beginning as a futuristic thing. You know, the scenarios were 100 years from now, 200 years from now. And there are studies about the discount rates. This is borrowed from economics that people apply to threats. If the threat is tomorrow, and we use it a lot in public health, in the global burden of disease assessments, in the original version that the World Health Organization and the World Bank did, they applied a 3% discount rate, which is the difference between confronting somebody about what they're doing today, such as drinking polluted water that may give them cholera tomorrow and die in a couple of weeks, versus smoking and the cancer will come 50 years from now. Yeah? This is why teenagers pick up smoking, because the risk is discounted, or the consequences are discounted. So for the African, it's not a luxury, in fact. Africans tend to apply different discount rates because it's tied to life expectancy. If you're only going to live up to 40, you know, the things that will kill you.
The other thing that somebody else said at a different conference, they pointed out that if everybody lived like Americans, we'd need nine Earths or whatever it is. But the answer to that is not to begrudge whatever African community they're referring to, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. We can't begrudge them wanting a fridge.
Yeah.
But while America's not prepared to give up, and we have a reasonable expectation of a reasonable standard of living, one of those has to give.
Yes. Yes. My response to that, as a this evolves as you learn more, but we don't have to follow the course what took Americans to that quality of life that's desired by most other people on Earth was extremely expensive. I am shocked that not still many houses in California, most houses in California still don't have solar panels on their roof. There is an alternative way to generate energy. Okay? There's no reason why African countries have to burn through a ton of petroleum to have lighting in every house, to have water, running water, which is a big challenge for public health. If we had clean, running, chlorinated water for every household in the African continent, we'll probably reduce the burden of disease by more than half. We can do that with the current technology and not have to reinvent the wheel in an expensive way. Can we have the same number of cars per capita that Americans drive? Maybe there are other ways. This is why we need to put our heads to how can we get to what we really want without going through that expensive process. And I think we have the technology to do so. Even as we push the frontiers of invention, you know, go to the moon and Mars and stuff, there are things we can do to not replicate that process and achieve the same endpoint. I think China is the example typically given. If every Chinese person wants to live like an American, yes, we'll need. We don't have the resources for that. But I refuse to say that the Chinese should give up improving their quality of life. I think with international support, we can all achieve that endpoint without the costs.
My favorite definition of sustainability is ethics expanded in space and time.
It's a fine definition. Yeah.
What is the... How is ethics framed in public health in a way that scales? Because I'm imagining that it has to, because you have to be immediately able to jump from the individual to the population.
Mm-hmm. The biggest challenges for ethics in public health is equity, which is not uncommon in other disciplines as well. Access to health and whether or not it's a human right, actually. and many public health professionals are on the side of, yes, it should be a fundamental right, and governments should act accordingly, and whereas others think it's a benefit that you should earn, and if you can't earn it, then so be it. You can fall sick and die, and we shouldn't care. Well,
and interestingly, that comes from both ends of the wealth spectrum.
Yeah.
For some of them, that's where we can't afford it, and others is we can afford it, but you can't afford it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's your fault. So, you know, there is another challenge that I give to my students, and I can't claim to have the solution. If public health were to accomplish its mission, is that a desirable goal? That is to say, does disease actually play a positive role in human society? Is it in fact desirable to have a world without illness, where we all live, I don't know, as long as the Japanese women, which is sort of the standard now. Can we imagine that world? What would that world look like? It's very difficult for anybody to say publicly that you know, that's a, you know, a goal we should or should not have.
And it comes down to the scaling, doesn't it? Because it's a, while you might think you might be able to possibly justify it at a theoretical population level, not so if it's your grandmother.
Yes. And you know, we keep growing and that, so there is that conundrum as to what is really our, you know, are we able to accomplish this? The reason it's not in the news is we're so far from accomplishing that goal that right now we need to put all the resources and energy and passion into correcting the equity issues, and you know, because we're not going to get to the point where every African, every Chinese,
even,
every Indian.
So even if you argued that the public health mission wasn't a desirable goal, that you did have to allow some disease, while that's being distributed in an unequal fashion, we have to address it. Is that
we have to address that equity part of everybody has, well, equal chance of getting sick. You know, that the diseases we can control are controlled everywhere, in a country, in a community, in the world, regardless of whether somebody can pay or not, right? I mean, that's what's achievable now, is we have the know-how and the technology to keep some diseases at bay for every person.
But while the richest country in the world has got a still broken healthcare system...
Yeah.
What hope is there for the rest of the world?
It's the same, in my thinking, it's the same solution to the problem of why isn't everybody living, able to live at the level, quality of life of Americans. Okay, the countries that are watching the disarray of the American healthcare system have alternatives. We don't have to go this route.
But the alternatives are the Nordic countries in particular.
Yeah.
But the way they achieve that is frightening to many Americans.
Taxing everybody. It is, and the U.S. will probably never settle on this issue. There's still a Supreme Court case that I wrote that was part of an amicus brief, you know, to address, and Obama spoke of it recently. So I imagine this will keep going. But is there a way to accomplish what the Nordic countries have accomplished without the ideological, you know, attacks of it being a communist or socialist, or I mean, those are labels. The real issue is everybody will agree that if a country can afford to keep its population healthy, then it should do so. And I actually believe every country on this planet can do that. Part of the reason we have not done so is we prioritize other things more than health. We spend more on defense. I can't imagine how angry I am that African countries, including Nigeria, spend more on defense than public health or education. We fight, we buy weapons. That's not, well, these are ethical issues too, but to me, you know, I don't know what it'll take. In the U.S., of course, also still spends more on defense than health, even though we spend a ton on twice as much than the next country on health, it's still not the same as what we spend on defense. So, you know, we're not going to solve that defense problem anytime soon. It looks even like it's going worse. But we need to keep the vigilance that the expenditure on healthcare, and it's not just about money. It's investment in translating what we know, what we already know how to do, to actual benefits. And I think this is not expensive, actually. Most countries can afford to do that.
And unfortunately, the seeming response to reaching limits, resource limits, is to retreat more and more into a defensive strategy.
Yeah. We don't like visionaries in the world. I think that retreat is despite, you know, people like you doing this kind of work and the sustainability science community is saying, you know, there are other ways to think about this. As a researcher, all it tells me is there's still some things we don't fully understand, because it doesn't make sense to me anyway, and I think to a lot of people that we.
I think that the answer lies in the positive story.
Okay.
And I think the answer lies in the transition towns. That they are focusing on telling and demonstrating a positive response. And I think that in public health, the fact that the part of the solution to transportation mm-hmm. is that people should be using active transport more.
Yeah.
And that also benefits public health and has all those other benefits. Yeah. So I think that those are the those are where the winds are.
Yes. So I'm involved in a project, just started this year, funded by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. It's called Orange County Partnerships to Improve Health in Communities, or Community Health, OCPH. They have a nice website. And the idea is to create what you just described, complete streets where people can ride and walk. Access to the food on the sidewalk will not be things that, you know, despite having walked a mile, you eat something that puts all the risk factors back. Fewer sugary drinks and things that make a community center. We'll start with Santa Ana to implement certain changes to the streets. And what CDC really wants to do, what they claim, is they funded many urban and suburban centers, about 80 of them, I believe, around the country, is to generate the evidence base. If you make complete streets safe, people will actually walk. That's the hypothesis. And if they do walk more, they will have less prevalence of diabetes and heart conditions. A lot of people believe we already have that evidence, but it makes sense, but we need like the randomized critical clinical control trials to show here's the p-value.
I think what it needs is demonstration that it works at scale.
Yes. So that's what CDC's mission is that, okay, if we do this in the smaller communities and then we aggregate the population size and the evidence, and then we can scale up somehow. And that's the challenge. I think it ties very well to your solution of the positive stories, that these things are, if we can replicate them, you know, we can cover the planet, essentially. And that will be a radical change. I like to think that we have examples of how this has happened in people who study in the social sciences about how ideas, even social networking on electronic gadgets, how it took over within a period of 20 years. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, the idea that cell phones will become the mode of communication in Nigeria, I mean, it happened like overnight, really. Partly because of dissatisfaction with the infrastructure that was there before, you know, telephone lines were in the storms for weeks, months sometimes. You wouldn't be able to call. And so it appealed to people that here's this other way of doing things that seemed to solve a lot of your problems. Of course, it comes with its own problems, but I think these demonstration projects, engaging mayors and leaders and governors and those positive examples can make a change.
And there's tipping points in there's tipping points in the norms, isn't there? Because I've forgotten the exact numbers, but the transition from 90% horse drawn to 90% petrol driven was remarkably fast.
That's the phrase I was looking for, the tipping point. And there are some people who study that, you know, how do you recognize at the early stages and don't retreat, take a step back, right? As you were saying, because what we don't know is how many potential tipping points we've had, and we just retreated. So if we're able to recognize, you know, here's what's desirable, here are some ingredients, and we're already, you know, taking two steps, maybe three more, and so let's keep going. That would be, if somebody were to come up with that kind of predictable.
So how to recognize when we're getting near a tipping point and making sure we go past
exactly.
And then how to socially engineer getting to those tipping points.
Getting to those points.
Some questions to end with.
Yeah.
What's been the biggest success for you in the last couple of years?
Oh, professionally, I mean, here on our university campus, just seeing the program in public health blossom is, I couldn't have asked for a better period of my career. I think it's always, you know, the biographies I've read, things are difficult at the beginning, but it's always a good phase to be when you have been part of the establishment of something that was not there and now seems to be here to stay. The other aspect is my own research, maintaining my collaboration with colleagues in engineering, material science, not only in California, in the United States, and internationally, around the topic of toxic chemicals in electronic waste and things like that have been very, very rewarding. We've published some interesting articles. I've learned a lot.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes, more recently than in my earlier days as a professor. I think I was reluctant to put my own ideas expressed more in a message way than in just reporting the science when I was younger. These days, I'm very conscious of the importance of the discussion section of a paper. And also in trying as much as possible to connect more with journalists to respond to their inquiries in a more, I want this work to mean something to people because it potentially can move things forward in the directions of sustainability and mitigating risk factors that I know we can avoid. So I've done more of that in recent years, and if you consider that to be activism, then it is. So I'm not content with just publishing and sitting back and let others interpret it. I want to say what I think about it. I have participated in the State of California's Green Ribbon Science Panel to help the state develop policies that will eliminate toxic chemicals in consumer products sold in the state. I agreed to serve on that in part because I wanted to be part of the process of translating the research into protective policies. So it's mild activism, but I mean, I haven't done the Greenpeace thing, climbing onto buildings and things, but
may have probably have made more change. More
well, I'm sure Greenpeace is effective in their own way, but you know, I think there are these other more subtle but important ways to accomplish the same goal. Yeah,
it's remarkable the number of people that say, I'm not a Greenpeace activist. And then I interviewed the head of policy from Greenpeace, and his response was, well, I'm not a Greenpeace activist.
Well, that's again, it's a framing issue. I think people have, they see pictures of...
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
There's still a lot to be done. I'm still very excited about the opportunities and to change things, to educate and to discover. We have a logo for public health that we print on all of our T-shirts. Actually, it's on the back of my research reflect. Reveal and reform. And I have various pieces of work at different stages of that quartet. So some ongoing research, I'm still interested in completing them. Revealing is this publication on activism and trying to let people know. I'm so thrilled to teach Foundations of Public Health class every fall quarter, which they help me reflect on some things that I've, some of my assumptions sometimes. And we're using a case study approach, and I, every quarter, I'm challenged by the students, and some also see things in ways that they've never thought they would, given that we bring in public health students from various graduate students from different disciplines. What? And reform, as I mentioned, I signed on to this amicus brief, but to the Supreme Court, because I really want the Affordable Care Act to stay the way it was intended.
What challenges do you have in the next couple of years?
We're lucky to be at the stage where the program in public health should and will become a school of public health in the University of California system. That's a lot of proposals and maybe politicking and explaining things to people why public health is important. We have a vision of being the third school of public health in the 10 campus UC system. That's still fewer than it should be. UCLA is the younger one, and that's been 1960. So for a state this large and diverse and crossroads, we need more public health professionals, and workforce is important to that. And research. In my own work, I really look forward to continuing some of my collaborations. It's been the richest part of my research career. I like being exclusively focused on microbiology and going to the lab, but helping me think through how that's relevant to the big picture and not just be at the end of the pipeline where the hazardous stuff comes and we're just dealing with it. Upstream, with the engineers and the manufacturers, and I've had the privilege of talking to a lot of companies and representatives, and you know, I know most of them want to do the right thing. It's a struggle with economic bottom line and So we've done probably what I think we could do with electronic waste. I think there's now the case is proven, but we still need to protect people who are exposed. We started working on solar panels because I want to see that in every household in on the roof, thatched roof in Africa, mm-hmm. there's a solar panel. But I also know that those things need to be handled properly because we still can't make them without some toxic chemicals. And having this technology leapfrog some of the problems that we've had in the U.S., but implemented in sustainable ways in Africa and parts of, you know, India, China, places that really can use this technology, but we need to make sure it's safe. And
if you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by tomorrow morning, what would it be?
Oh, I printed a holiday card 2 years ago that we sent to all of our colleagues and supporters in public health, and it said, "A world where we all die of old age." Some of my colleagues rebelled and said we should never put "die" in a holiday card, but that's what I really want, I think. Is it possible? I think it's possible. It doesn't mean a world where we never die, because that's unrealistic and it's against the, you know, but I would like to see such a world, actually.
Lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
For business?
No, for our listeners.
When we talk about populations, it's made up of individuals. We're all responsible for our education, for changing our behavior. The message is the same for all of us. Collectively, we can move if individually we take a step.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Fascinating discussion.
Thank you. This was delightful. I always learn more than I share, but that's part of the process.
Thank you.
Okay.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we are building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Dr. Dele Ugusheta. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. I'm supported tonight by the Newkirk Centre for Science and Society. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.